very much.
Thank you very much. This is about as warm and generous and neighborly a welcome as a man could expect. And for that, I'm grateful. But I got to, you know, this is also an audience of New Englanders who aren't accustomed to saying too much most of the time. And as I came up through, someone handed me this as a warning, and I'd like to read it to you. It's a gentle warning, but it's a warning. A speech is a solemn responsibility. The man who makes a bad 30-minute speech to 200 people wastes only a half hour of his own time, but he wastes 100 hours of the audience's time, more than 4 days, which should be a hanging offense. Now, I can think of a story that makes that same point even better. This is the story of a Down East Yankee farmer whose hearing was going bad. And so he went to see his doctor. His doctor said, "Well, how much do you drink?" He said, "Well, I drink about a quart a night." Well, the doctor said, "If you don't stop drinking, you're going to lose your hearing altogether." Well, the fella said, "You know, Doc, I like what I've been drinking so much better than what I've been hearing, but I think I'll just keep on going." And I suppose that's true in New Hampshire every 4 years. And yet, of course, we've met here tonight to discuss at least one or two things of common interest. First of all, it's no longer a secret as to what I'm trying to do this year. I'm trying to make sure that we have a new president coming here from now. And I intend to try to be that man. But whether or not I am isn't really the important point. The important point is that we need a new president. I hope you won't mind if I use at least a few minutes of those few minutes to which I ought to limit myself, reminiscing just a bit. I was born in this valley of the Androscoggin, as I think most of you know. I was born in a mill town south of Burley. And I know what that is. Burley and Rumford are very much alike. One-horse towns, in the sense that both towns, for most of my lifetime, have been dependent upon a single industry. And this industry has been the economic base, which has provided the jobs, the income, the towns, the schools, the opportunity, the future, and the character of the life we live. And I lived in that town for 18 years until I went to school. But I've never forgotten that town. And I've never forgotten this part of the country and the problems that are associated with these circumstances here in the Androscoggin Valley. It's a strange mixture, as most places are in America, of opportunity, of doubt, of limitations, of frustrations and discontent, as well as hopes and promise. And so all my life, I think of the people of the Androscoggin Valley as people who've been concerned about job security or insecurity, as people who've been concerned about the beauty of this area, the purity of its streams, the cleanness and crispness of its air, the openness of its spaces. It's an area people have been concerned about these things for most of my lifetime. And you who are young in this room, that level of concern was not nearly as high when I was young as it is now, because the impact of these problems is more visible today than it was when I was young. My driving urge as a youngster of high school age, when I was here, is revealed best, I suppose, in what I had to say as an 18-year-old. Last March, my mother rummaged into the attic of her house in Rumford, where she still lives and where I lived as a boy. And she found the text of a speech I made to my high school class on graduating night. And you'd be interested to know what the subject of that speech was. In June of 1932, it was peace. And why? Because just 2 or 3 years earlier, the leading nations of the world had signed a piece of paper which they hoped and which they must have believed could bring peace to mankind in the 1930s. That piece of paper was the Kellogg-Briand Peace Pact, designed to outlaw war. Because that objective so appealed to the imagination and the hopes and dreams of the young people of 1932, I made my speech to my graduating class on that subject, expressing the hope that that indeed would be its impact. Well, of course, you don't need me to tell you that that isn't the way it has been. Since that time, we've had more wars, more people killed in wars, than in all the previous history of mankind. We were also concerned in those days, as young people, with preserving the beauty of our surroundings. And it was truly beautiful, in a way that isn't as evident today, even though we still think that this part of the country has so much more to offer than almost any other. But we hoped also that our waters would always be as clean as they then were, and they weren't all clean then. We hoped that the main woods and lakes, this included New Hampshire, would always offer recreational opportunities of the kind that we knew. And that has changed since I was a boy. And so the dreams, the hopes, are not that much different. In many ways, the problem of achieving them is a greater problem than it was then. And yet in other ways, we've made significant progress. So the challenge is whether or not we can make it possible for people to enjoy fruitful lives, to have lives of opportunity, to build something better for their children, and at the same time, to live in a beautiful, healthy, and worthwhile environment. That's a more difficult challenge today than it was 30 years ago, but it still is a challenge that we can meet. Now I'll tell you one difference between the time when I was in high school and today. When I graduated from high school in 1932, we were in the depths of a depression. This doesn't mean I'm going to talk too long. It's just we were in the midst of a depression. And the country was in a period of great doubt about its ability to respond to the needs of our people. And yet I do not recall that even at that time there was the doubt about our ability to meet the future that I find in Americans of all descriptions across this country today. We have economic problems today, but they're not as serious as they were then. We don't have the problems connected with the war, or we did not then, that we have today. And we still had the problems in both instances of convincing people and persuading people that we could build something better. And we believed that. And we believed it especially in 1932, after President Roosevelt was elected and took office and made us believe once again that whatever we were determined to achieve, we could achieve. Now that is what I think our country has to do again. We live in a time of doubt. Doubt as to our purposes, doubt as to our ability, doubt as to whether or not some of these problems can be solved. We live at a time of suspicion. Different groups of Americans are suspicious of other groups of Americans about their goodwill, about their intentions, about their purposes. We live in a time of doubt about government, whether or not government is truly responsive to our people. And I say to you that there isn't a problem that we face today that we can't solve if we want to, if we make up our minds to do so, and if we're willing to agree among ourselves as to what is important, what is less important, and what is unimportant. I believe that because I read it in the faces of Americans of all descriptions from one end of this country to the other. The people of this area may seem different from the people of other areas. They may seem different from people of other backgrounds and of other colors and of other traditions and of different experiences. But all Americans are alike in their basic hopes and aspirations. Most Americans really want peace for our country. And they want a country dedicated to peace. And they want a country committed to the objective of moving not only this country, but mankind as a whole in the direction of peace. It has been one of our ideals as a country that I remember as a boy, and that my immigrant father used to remind me of, that this country represents the desirability of peace as the condition of man. We've come to doubt that in recent years. Our young people especially have come to doubt that in recent years. And worse than that, other people overseas have come to doubt that in recent years. And so we have to reestablish the credibility of our peaceful ideal here in America. Secondly, all Americans like to believe that this is a land of opportunity for them. And all Americans believe that, fundamentally, that if they are to have opportunity, opportunity must be within the reach of all Americans, whoever they are. There's no way of piecing it out so that a few have opportunity and others do not. Because we cannot have hope to have domestic peace here in America unless all Americans believe that there's something better in their future. And I don't find that this is anything different, that I came to learn as a boy 50 miles downstream in Rumford. This is a lesson we were taught by our parents, by our teachers. This is a lesson we came to believe was the ultimate objective of our country. Thirdly, we've got to believe, as we used to, that the way you achieve both of these first objectives, peace as an ideal and a national policy, opportunity as a way of life for our people, is education. There's a very mixed picture about education in this country today. When I was first elected governor, I could persuade my people to support any taxes, any increase in taxes, in the name of education. Because all Americans instinctively understand that if people are to break out of the cycle of poverty, if they're to enlarge their own opportunities for happiness, the education is important. Whether it's in public schools, or private schools, or religious-oriented schools, or whatever, education is fundamental. Why, then, this recent resistance to educational bond issues and to taxes in the name of education? The resistance comes from the fact that Americans doubt that they're getting the kind of education for which they're being asked to pay, which goes back to my original point. But that education is a key to the future of our people as individuals and our country as a nation, I think is something that Americans fundamentally believe. Well, I could go down through the whole list, and I could document and, I think, demonstrate that Americans, whoever they are, believe in these values, in these ideas. Peace, opportunity, education, a clean environment. Go down through the list, and I can go or take you into any group of Americans across this land, and I won't find any disagreement as to these as objectives. Why, then, are we bogged down? Why are we so divided? Why are we so suspicious? Well, a couple of reasons. I think the great catalyst, which has really triggered all of this negative attitude among Americans, has been the war. There are other reasons, but the war. A second reason has been the fact that as Americans get to know more about how other Americans live, the injustices of our society are clearer to us all. Racial injustice, the injustice which makes old age a burden, the injustice which makes some people bear a heavier share of the burdens of supporting government than others better able to pay. All of the injustices are clearer, more visible in a television and radio age than they ever were before. That's the second reason. And then thirdly, of course, is the fact that doubt feeds on doubt. Once we began to doubt our country over the war, once we began to doubt our government over the question of justice, we began to doubt everything else. Well, I see this election campaign in 1972 as a way to get all of this out of our system, as a time when we can lay all these problems on the table, as a time when we can discuss them truthfully, honestly, frankly, and directly, as a time when we can begin to agree on what is important, what is less important, and what is unimportant. As a time when we can begin to make commitments to the important values of them all. And they're no different than they were when I was a boy in Rumford, living within a half mile of the Androscoggin River. Now I'll tell you why I'm against President Nixon. Why I think we need a new president. Why I think we need new policies. And I'll do it on his own terms. 3 years ago, after he'd taken office, in a speech that I remember well on television, he said that he would be judged, would expect to be judged, on three promises he had made in the 68 campaign. The first promise was to end the war. Since he made that promise, 3 years have passed. 40% of all the Americans who have died in Vietnam have died since he made that promise. We've spent $50 billion more on that war since he made that promise. And he's still trying to explain to us why he can't end it. And I say to you, that isn't good enough. The second promise he made was that he'd create 15 million more jobs and that he'd solve the problem of inflation without creating unemployment. Now, what has he done there? You know, here in the Berlin area, but let me give you the national figures as well as the state figures. Inflation has grown over this period from a little over 4% to a little over 6% at its peak. Unemployment grew from a little under 3.5% to over 6% at its peak, and its peak was reached last month, 6.1% nationally, 7.3% here in the Berlin area. Instead of 15 million more jobs, he's created 4 million more jobs, which hasn't been enough to take care of the young people coming on the job market, as well as taking care of those misplaced by economic slowdown and technological change in this country, so that today over 5 million Americans are without jobs, don't know where they're coming from, and another 75 to 80 million who are employed are fearful they may lose their jobs. And if we take into account those who are working less, those who have lost overtime, those families which have lost a second job, more than 20% of working Americans have felt the effect of economic slowdown, as you have here in Berlin. What are some of the other effects of this economic policy? We've had the highest interest rates since the Civil War. Last year was the first year in 10 years that economic growth stopped in this country. Last year was the first year in 10 years that the number of people in poverty increased. Last year is the first year, every year gets worse. Last year was the first year since 1893 that we had a trade deficit. In other words, last year, for the first time, how much is that? 8 and 71. 78 years. 79. My mathematics is almost as bad as the president's. That we didn't earn enough as a nation. This great nation with a $1 trillion economy didn't earn enough as a nation overseas to pay the salary of a single ambassador or a single soldier or a single Peace Corps volunteer. This great nation of ours, for the first time. No, I don't know how much balance of payments means to you, but balance of payments represents our international bank account, whether we are earning more or less. Earning more than we're taking in or less than we're taking in. Back in 1964, we had a balance of payments deficit of $3.5 billion for the year. And Republicans, including Mr. Nixon, were preaching gloom and doom in the mismanagement of the Democratic administration. Well, we dealt with that problem, and in 1968, the last year of the Johnson administration, we had a surplus, over $1.5 billion. What happened this year? In the third quarter of this year alone, of 71 alone, we had an international payments, balance of payments deficit of $13 billion. And for the year as a whole, over $30 billion, or almost 10 times as much of a deficit. In the year of this responsible Republican administration than in the worst year of the 60s, when two Democratic presidents had the problem of working us out of the Republican recession of 1960. This president has been an economic disaster for the country. An economic disaster. He talks about his new prosperity. Do you know what that is? By his own terms, his own targets? Is he promising something as good as we had when he took office? Something better? No. His target, this new prosperity target, is an unemployment level 40% higher than when he took office. I'll take the old prosperity for my money rather than this new one. But then how about the other target? His other target is a price level 17% higher than when he took office. Now, what does that mean to you? It means that if you earn $100 a week today, you are paying $14 of that $100 as your share of the cost of Mr. Nixon's inflation. $14 a week is what the new prosperity means to you. Out of your grocery budget, out of your rent budget, out of your education budget, out of your tax budget. 14 bucks a week out of 100 that you're paying for this administration's mismanagement of our economy. The president will be telling you this next year about the tax cuts that he got for you last year. It doesn't begin to offset this inflation cut that he's produced in your budget. Well, the sins of this administration are so many, and the list is so long, that I couldn't possibly cover all of them in the 30 minutes that my friend in the audience gave me. But I'll tell you what his greatest sin of all was. In the last campaign, he had a good piece of advice. He was given a good piece of advice, and he recognized it when he saw it. It wasn't from one of his campaign advisors. It wasn't from those who put together that program, Selling of the President. It was from a little girl who held up a sign saying, bring us together. And he adopted that as his theme, used it in his inaugural address, and yet the thrust of all of his policies ever since has been to divide Americans against each other. We've got more division in this country, more doubt about the purposes of our country and our government, more doubt about each other than we had before he took office, because he simply cannot avoid setting group against group, setting people against people, in the hope of building the narrow political base necessary to re-elect him to public office. He has divided this country when he pledged to bring it together. And the failure to keep that promise is the biggest failure of all. Because if he had kept that one, we could have taken the rest of it. Having failed to keep that one, then he's raised doubts among us as to our ability to deal with the rest of it. I want to say to you, on a personal note, just to close, you know, I set a theme for my campaign a week ago when I pledged the new beginning. Well, I didn't really think that that meant getting married over again.
Three times.
Well, that's having too many new beginnings for me. You know, one of my advisors suggested a line to use that would go like this. Mr. Nixon would do anything to keep his job. What has he done to help you keep yours? So I just want to inject this personal note at this point. I'm going to be traveling New Hampshire a great deal in the next 8 weeks, trying to cover other states as well. It's very presumptuous for a man, and I'm sure for a woman, to believe himself or herself capable of filling this awesome responsibility of the presidency. It isn't easy to bring yourself to a belief that you can do so. I certainly never set it up as the target of my life, even of my political life. I certainly never believed it would be within my reach as recently as 3 years ago. And now it is. And I've tried to test myself against what I understand to be the expectations of our people with respect to the presidency. No man can make that judgment for himself finally. The people he seeks to lead must make that judgment. And so I hope you'll test me, because I don't want to go into the presidency on the basis of my own ambition or my own judgment as to my qualifications. I would want to feel that you believe in me and my possibility for filling this job. That's why I get so much out of meetings like this and the meetings I have with people up and down the streets and in the factories and mills and the stores of America. I want to believe that you believe in my potential for this office. And as I see the responsibilities of the presidency beginning a year from now, indeed now if we could do anything about it, but for a year from now, the next president must be a man who can help us believe in ourselves and our country once more. And if he can do that, we'll have what we want. Let me say this one other thing. Yes, sir.
What do you think about this price freeze?
I'm asked what do I think about the price freeze?
Yeah. Wage freeze.
The wage freeze, the price freeze. Well, first of all, and I don't want to get into a long economic speech, but I got to say something as a beginning to that answer. First of all, the president created problems for himself when he said in January of 1969 that he would never use wage price controls or wage price guidelines of any kind to try to control inflation. And he said, in addition, that he would expect labor and management to make their own decisions with respect to prices and wages in accordance with the interests of their organizations. That was the guideline he laid down 3 years ago. And so labor did what he suggested. Labor used the collective bargaining process to offset the impact of inflation upon wages. And overall, in the next year and a half to 2 years, negotiated increases, which were about at the annual rate of inflation 1.5 years afterwards. Then the president changed the rules and said you were wrong to labor to do this, and we're not going to let you enjoy the benefits of the contracts that you negotiated. Yes, sir. What about it? Well, I don't know. That's a state tax. It isn't. There's no proposal to increase any federal tax on it. Well, let me say thank you for coming here tonight. I ask for your help in the next weeks ahead, and if you give it to me, we'll go on to victory across the country. Thank you.